And welcome to Wine with Wilson, the podcast for everyone who's interested in wine and all the things to do with it. I'm Wilson, and today what we're going to do is talk about something really exciting, the sparkling wine industry. I was once asked by a friend that if I could only have one wine that I drank for the rest of my life, what would that wine be? And it's an interesting game to play because initially I thought, oh, well, it would have to be something like a delicious, savoury Pinot Noir that would go with almost any kind of food. And then I thought about winter and I thought about how relaxing and comforting a lovely, rich glass of Merlot or maybe even a Cab Sav, a Bordeaux blend is. And then when I really thought about it, the wine that I don't think I could go past, the wine that I would miss the most if I couldn't drink anything else ever again, would be champagne. And by that, I do really mean champagne, not just sparkling wines, but champagne from France, grown in the traditional method, made in the traditional method. I think if I had to choose one wine that I was going to drink for the rest of my life, that would be it. And I wouldn't be too fussy about which one it was either. There are so many to choose from. So, with that kind of little anecdote out of the way, what I want to talk about today in this podcast is a whole range of different sparkling wines, mainly ones that are made in that champagne method. So I think when you go to buy a bottle of bubbles, it can be a little bit overwhelming. The choices are enormous and the price point difference between those choices is also enormous. From, you know, under $10 sometimes for a bottle of what is basically soda streamed wine, right through to hundreds, if not thousands of dollars for a bottle of wine, which has been made in champagne. So what are the differences between them? How do you choose? I think that's what the questions that today's podcast are going to try and answer for you. So let's start at the very beginning. Let's actually start with champagne. It's become the ubiquitous term for sparkling wines. People talk about champagne even when they're not actually talking about wines that were made in that particular region of France. And I think that probably makes our French colleagues, green with anger. Is that the right word? Am I mixing metaphors there? So let's start with genuine champagne, what it is, what makes it a champagne, what's special about it, why it costs so much, and what you should actually expect from a bottle if you do buy one. So champagne is one of the wines of the world which has the most rules associated with it, which has the most restrictions around what can and can't be called champagne, and where the name itself is guarded, you know, incredibly jealously, and for good reason, because of the price point that a genuine champagne can achieve. So it's a region of France, a region around the city of Reims. It's actually a relatively small region, and the boundaries are to some extent a little bit arbitrary, as the boundaries for lots of these sort of French regions are. The terroir, in terms of the physical aspects of the land, means that it's mainly on chalk. And of course, that's why, as a little bit of an aside, English sparkling, which is grown just across the channel effectively from the Champagne region, actually can be very similar, because it's actually grown on very, very similar land. So we've got a small region with very closely defined boundaries, and then there are a whole series of other rules if you want to call it champagne. So obviously you have to grow it within the region, that's the first one, but you also have to bottle it within 100 miles of the region. So the bottling and where it's bottled is also controlled. Then there are a whole series of rules about how you can prune your vines, about how big your yield is allowed to be from the vines. So in other words, you actually have to throw away a whole lot of grapes if your vines are growing too much, or you have to restrict the way that your vines are growing grapes. And this is, of course, about quality. This is about ensuring that rather than just getting loads and loads of grapes, you're actually getting the very best grapes. That's why there are controls about yields. There's also a control on the yield from the pressing. In other words, you're not supposed to press and press and press your grapes. You're looking for the top quality juice. Again, this is about trying to control the quality of the product. And I think you can begin to see why something which is actually called a champagne is going to cost you a little bit more. In fact, probably quite a lot more. There is also rules about the minimum amount of alcohol that you're allowed to have in your wine. And this, of course, is to do with the ripeness of the grapes, and it's a way of ensuring that grapes are being picked at the optimum ripeness, but also that there is a whole lot of sophistication in the way that the wine is being made, so that grapes that have a particular level of ripeness, therefore a particular level of sugar in them, are also being vinified to, on the whole, be dry. So there are sweet champagnes, there are sort of dessert champagnes, but I think the wine that most of us associate with champagne is something which is extremely dry, bone dry often. So those are some of the rules associated with making a champagne and with what you have to do and have to meet to be able to have your wine labelled in that way. Then we come to the actual grapes. So there are three main grapes that make up the bulk of champagne, and two of those are actually red. That's Pinot Noir, which many of us will recognise, and a grape called Meunier, or sometimes Pinot Meunier. These are both red-skinned grapes, and they contribute to the wine a lot of those flavours of sort of fruitiness, of aromatics, the floral smell and flavour you sometimes get in a really good champagne comes often from Meunier. And they give it the sort of some of the richness that champagne has. The other grape that's well known in champagne, of course, is Chardonnay. Chardonnay is a white grape, and so when you get things like a Blanc de Blanc, you'll have seen that term on champagnes, a Blanc de Blanc, a white of white, what you have is a 100% Chardonnay wine. If it says Blanc de Noir, then what you've got is a wine that has been made from those two red-skinned or black-skinned grapes, so white of black. We'll come to rosé champagnes later, because that's a completely different issue. But let's look at some of the other grapes, because it's not particularly well known, but there are at least four other grapes which are permitted in the Champagne region. And together they make up sort of about 0.03 of the hectarage of the percentage of land which is actually grown for grapes for champagne. But they are still interesting things to talk about. There's a grape called Arbane, a grape called Petit Messillier, and also two grapes which you might recognise, Pinot Blanc, which is becoming more popular here in New Zealand, and Pinot Gris, which I think probably everyone would recognise and has probably drunk. That sort of really quite recognisable pear flavour, I think, is the thing I always associate with Pinot Gris. So those four grapes can be used in champagnes as well. And what generally is happening in the champagne houses is that there is an assemblage, a mixing of the different grapes that are available. Sometimes some Champagne houses are putting out single varietal champagnes. These are often more expensive and really sort of showcase the characteristics of those particular grapes. But often the champagnes are a mix of those first three, but also with some of the others thrown in. So that tells us what are the basics of a champagne, where it comes from, the rules around it, the grapes that it's being made from. But it's the process of making champagne which is particularly special. So what you're doing is you are taking the juice, and in the case of the red-skinned or black-skinned grapes, that juice has been pressed very carefully and taken straight off the skins so that there is virtually no colour. Remember that the colour in red wine comes not because the fruit is red itself. The inside of almost all grapes, there are very, very few exceptions. The Georgian grape Saperavi is one of the few. The inside of the grape is white, whereas the even if the skins are red. And so the juice that comes from grapes, even red-skinned grapes, is white juice, which is how you're able to make a white wine, a white champagne from something like Pinot Noir or Meunier. So the juice is extracted and is fermented in the normal way that you would ferment a white wine. Then the part of the process that actually starts to make something into a champagne occurs. So the first part of that process is what's called assemblage. So this is the blending. This is where the winemaker looks at their different tanks of first fermentation wine that's come from various parts of their vineyard, from various different grapes. And also this is where they might be able to bring in wine from previous vintages to be able to make a house style. And they blend the wines together till they get the flavour that they're looking for. So in the case of large champagne houses, this means looking for that house style, so that the bottle of wine that you buy this year will taste the same as the bottle of wine you bought last year and the year before, and so on and so forth. So large champagne houses are usually looking for a house style, and the assemblage is in order to achieve that. In small champagne houses, in what's sometimes called grower champagne, so these are a small people who are growing their own grapes and then making their own champagnes, often family owned, then the assemblage is more about getting the best out of the wine that they have available to them. It may be in order to create a house style as well, but there's less of a focus on that. So we've got the assemblage, a very complex process, one which we could probably do an entire podcast about, but we won't at this point. Then we go on to the next part of the champagne making, which is the bit where the actual magic, I guess, happens. And that's the second fermentation. So for it to be called champagne, that second fermentation has to occur in the bottle. So the wine is bottled and is left to go through a secondary fermentation process. And what's happening here is that all of the yeast that is in the wine as it's bottled from the fermentation is left in the bottle, and it continues to work. So the first thing that happens there is that as yeast eats the sugars in grape juice and creates alcohol, which is how fermentation is occurring, it also creates as a byproduct carbon dioxide. I like to think of it as yeast farts, but maybe you prefer not to think about drinking that. So the yeast farts, the carbon dioxide that the yeast produces as a byproduct, make the bubbles in the wine. But we also have the problem that we've got the yeast in there. And what champagne makers realized fairly early on was that people wanting to pay premium prices also wanted to have nice, clear wine. So while the wine is left to sit on that yeast, what's sometimes called the lees, you'll have heard that expression, the lees, while the wine is left to sit on that for quite some time in order to develop complexity, it's to develop those flavours that we really associate with champagne, that flavour of brioche, of bread, of biscuits, that toasty, delicious flavour that you get from a proper champagne. They don't want the yeast to be in there when the product is finally sold to the consumer. So what happens then is that the bottles go through a process which is called riddling. Now, the person who we believe may have come up with this is the Widow Clicquot, Veuve Clicquot. You'll have seen the distinctive yellow bottles. You've possibly even drunk some. It's a particularly nice champagne, I would say. She is credited with coming up with the process of riddling, and we are talking hundreds of years ago still. So what riddling is that the bottle is taken from being in a horizontal position, lying on its side, all the way up to being in a vertical position, but upside down. And this is done slowly over a number of days, the bottle being half turned each day and the angle being slowly increased. This used to be done by hand on what was called a riddling board. The story goes that the Widow Clicquot tipped over her wooden kitchen table, drilled a whole series of holes into it, and shoved the bottlenecks in them, making the world's first riddling board. And that is still effectively what a riddling board looks like, a large board with a number of holes on it in an A-frame shape so that the wines can be slowly taken up to being vertical and upside down while being turned. And what that turning and moving to vertical process is doing is that it is tipping the lees, the dead yeast that's still in the bottle, into the neck, and as far into the neck as is possible, because the next part of the process is disgorging. So in order to disgorge the wine, what we do these days is we freeze the necks of the bottle so that the lees becomes a little solid plug of dead yeast, and the top is flipped off. It's been topped with a crown cap, like the kind of caps you get on a beer bottle. The top is flipped off and the plug of frozen yeast bursts out of the bottle, and the wine has been disgorged. What then happens is what's called a dosage is added. So this is effectively a sweetening agent, and the amount of dosage that gets put in, and it's sweetened grape juice, sometimes some brandy, something that doesn't have any flavour but has the sweetness. This is added in order to moderate the amount of acid and the flavour of the final wine, so that what you're doing is you are affecting the taste that the wine will finally have by this addition. So you'll sometimes see things that say zero dosage. Right, don't get confused. That does not mean zero alcohol. It just means that there was no added sugar after the disgorging. And so those wines will be particularly dry, absolutely crisp, absolutely bone dry. Whereas most champagnes will have a small amount of sugar added. The wine itself is already incredibly dry. And so the sugar creates a little bit of a balance and a wine which is often much more drinkable. So after the dosage has been added, that's when the cork that we all know and love, with its very distinct sort of, I think, toadstool is the way I always think of them, shape is put in, the wire cage to hold it in place, because the amount of pressure inside that bottle is enormous, as anyone who has nearly taken someone's eye out when they've opened one will know. Not speaking from experience, obviously. The wire cage and the foil that we now associate with being part of the champagne experience is added at this point. Then the wine may well be left to sit down and age further. Wines that are called vintage wines that wines that all come from a single year's vintage are often very age-worthy and can continue to change and adapt and evolve inside the bottle for quite some time. For, if you would believe, some of the big champagne houses, for tens of years. Wines that are called non-vintage or have NV on them are wines that have been blended from a range of different years and vintages in order to achieve a house style. And while they certainly can be left alone for a number of years, they're not necessarily going to improve any during that time. So that's something to sort of think about in terms of whether you want aged champagnes or not. If you are going to buy a vintage champagne to mark a birthday or something like that, then make sure that you're choosing something of a sufficient quality that it will actually last the distance and not be a disappointment when you do finally pop the cork. Speaking of which, it's probably worth talking about how one goes about opening a bottle of champagne. Now, I think we all enjoy that little pop sound that the cork makes. And there is something really quite fun about seeing how far you can flick that cork across the lawn. I would agree with that. But as my wine educator once said to me, it is actually rather gauche to make that popping noise. And it's rather gauche to try and fire the wine as far as you possibly can across the lawn. So I would highly recommend that you use instead the method which sommeliers use in the restaurants. So the whole idea is that you keep your hand over the cork for as long as possible. In fact, you should keep your hand over the cork for the entire process of doing the opening. Take off the foil, loosen the cage, and then keep your hand firmly over the cork while you twist the bottle rather than the cork. If you can do it without making any sound at all, then you have been extremely successful. Just the tiniest little pift is also acceptable. So, you've got your bottle of wine open. Now, of course, the question is, what sort of glass should you put it in? And I think that the answer to that is quite a complex one. And there is a considerable argument about what sort of glasses one should best drink one's champagne in. I think most of us these days are used to pouring our champagnes or our sparkling wines, full stop, into flutes, and there are a huge range of shapes and sizes available. The other glass that has had a bit of a renaissance recently is what's called the coupe, the little sort of bowl-shaped glass, which I think looks rather pretty and is the sort of thing that you use if you are going to make a tower of champagne glasses, bottles. that would be a wonderful thing. Champagne towers are and fountains where you begin by pouring into the top glass and overflow it and so on. Look, they look very dramatic, but my goodness, the amount of nerve it takes to put one together, it means that it's not something that I've been that keen on doing anytime soon. So what you're going to do, the other kind of glass which has become, I think, quite popular are the little tulip-shaped glasses. They do look exactly like a little tulip, and they're very cute and they're very nice to drink out of. But there is actually a fourth contender, and that is pretty much a ordinary standard white wine glass. I was recently lucky enough to be at a masterclass with renowned glassmaker, Maximilian Riedel. And Riedel is the biggest glass manufacturing company in the world. And Maximilian is an 11th generation glassmaker. So they, you know, they're a company that might know what they're talking about. And he claims, and I haven't yet put this to the test, but he claims that their Sauvignon Blanc glass is the perfect glass for sparkling wine. And I can probably see what he means, because it is narrow enough and has a narrow enough top to keep those lovely bubbles kind of sparkling away in there. But it's actually big enough to let the wine get some air, and so you can actually taste some of the complexity that's going on in it. Because my argument would be that the big problem with your beautiful flute is that while it looks gorgeous, and while the shape emphasizes the bead, the bubbles in your champagne, that unfortunately, unless it's actually got quite a wide top, you actually lose a whole lot of the aromatics. And if you've spent quite a lot of money on a bottle of genuine French champagne, and let's face it, you're not going to get away with much change from $60 or $70 at the minimum, then my goodness, you want to experience that wine at the very best that it is. So I think a flute is pretty. I don't think it's necessarily going to hurt the wine, but I'm not sure that it's actually going to necessarily show it at its best. I have become a bit of a fan of the coupe, of those big bowl-shaped glasses. Now, if you are like me and you've saved the ones that your parents were given as wedding gifts in the 1960s, and they've got hollow stems, almost impossible to clean, let's not even go there, but they've got hollow stems, then you still get the bubble coming through. In fact, they keep the consistent bubble in almost exactly the same way that a flute does. But because it's got that beautiful wide bowl, not just does it look really cool, not just do you look a little bit like you've stepped out of a 1960s spy thriller as you're drinking it, but also you actually get to really experience the aromas and the flavours of the wine, because there's enough surface area for that to happen. And I think the same thing is true, particularly of just drinking it out of a standard, say, Sauvignon Blanc style glass. It doesn't have quite the same prettiness, and you are going to lose some of your bubbles, but you really are going to actually appreciate the flavours and the aromas of this beautiful wine. Because I think that's the whole thing, that at its best, that money that you've spent on that bottle of champagne is actually worth every single cent, because of the quality of those flavours, the complexity of it, the breadiness, the brioche-ness, the fruit that's underlying it, the wonderful clean acid line that a really good champagne has, the the yeastiness that's coming in underneath, the herbaceous flavours. I could possibly go on all day about this, and I'm hoping that you're all going to rush out straight after this and buy yourselves a bottle of something really nice. I'd recommend buying a bottle from a smaller house, a bottle of family-grown grower champagne, rather than putting the money into huge corporations and, you know, all of the big-name champagne houses now, or most of them, are no longer family owned. They're owned by huge alcohol corporations. So I'm always in favour of us supporting local small growers instead. So if you're going to go and buy a bottle of champagne, that's what I think you should be looking for. Knowing a little bit about how it's made and why it costs as much as it does, I think eases it a little bit. It's interesting. Things are tough down the wine mines at the moment, as anyone in the industry will tell you, and people don't have the discretionary spending money that they did. But one of the things that still seems to be selling really well is champagne. So maybe you should take a leaf from that book. A really nice treat. If you're going to have one bottle of wine this week, make sure it's a special bottle of wine. So that brings us to the close of another episode of Wines with Wilson. I hope you've enjoyed listening to this discussion about champagne, about one of the great wines of the world, which has such a fascinating history, and we could dig a little deeper into that history in future podcasts. This is the first part of many parts where we will look at a whole range of other sparkling wines, ones that are made in the traditional method, so made in the same method as champagne, but just in different regions and with different grapes. And we will take a look at some other kinds of sparkling wines that you might be seeing on the shelves in your local wine shop. So stay tuned. There will be more on the bubbles in future podcasts. Thanks for joining me today. I've been Carlene Wilson of Wilson Your Wine Butler and Colt Wine, and I've had a lovely time chatting to you about champagne on this episode of Wines with Wilson.